In this episode of Startups of the Rest of Us, Mike and I talk about options for finding funding or an acquisition offer, setting up a U.S. company as a non-U.S. citizen, and when to think about letting someone go. This is Startups of the Rest of Us, episode 323. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Rob.
And I'm Mike.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we made. So where this week, sir?
Well, I wanted to say congratulations to Sherry Walling for Zen Founder being selected for Entrepreneur.com's list of 24 exceptional women-hosted podcasts for entrepreneurs in 2017. And obviously, you are the co-host of that show, but definitely wanted to send a congratulations to her for being mentioned on that list. I think that's quite an accomplishment.
Yeah, it was a big deal. It seemed to get a bit of notice. People were taking notice, and I know we got some big bump in email subscribers, Zen Founder email subscribers, as well as some more podcast downloads. So. It's always fun to be recognized for something like that.
Yeah, and after a short period too. I mean, the podcast hasn't been around for very long, so it's nice to see that kind of traction.
So for me, kind of mellow this morning. I'm still getting back onto time zone because I was in California for about 8 or 9 days in Santa Cruz, hanging out with family, friends, reconnecting with people. So it was a really, really nice time. You know, it's a lot warmer there, so. Still was wearing sweatshirts and stuff, about a 50-60 degree difference depending on the day. And so I'm still, like I said, an hour or two off time zone. So I'm getting going this morning, but it was good. And it just reminded me how important it is to take some time off and recharge now and again. And depending on your level of exhaustion or burnout, maybe you need to take a little time off every month. And at other times, you can take a little time off every quarter or every 6 months. But it's really important to come back. And I just feel a lot more motivated and like I have clarity of thought because I had this time to kind of step away from work and stop thinking about it.
Cool. Well, on my end, I added another paying customer for Bluetick in advance of my public launch, and I also integrated Zapier into the equation. So
you got Zapier done, huh? That's cool.
Yeah, like there's a couple of things left with triggers to be able to send data outside of it and allow Zapier to kind of natively subscribe to different events that happen inside of Bluetick. But I would say all but one piece of being able to trigger different things inside of Bluetick is done in Zapier, and then there's just this last piece of being able to allow them to subscribe to events. So once those are done, then, you know, I should be able to start rolling that out a little bit more. I've got a couple of people using those Zaps right now. Most of them are going into my Zapier account, and then I'm just kind of piping them through Zapier back into Bluetick because when you create that Zapier integration, obviously it's create a personal private one first, and then you can share it. So I'm slowly going in that direction just because I don't fully understand all the implications of the decisions I'm making in Zapier. So I'm trying to be a little cautious about putting that out there in a way that makes it difficult for me to modify it later.
Right. Yeah, for sure. That's the nice part is when you have that private Zap, then you can, like you said, share it with other people. And I think they want you to have like 10 active users before they will move it to production. That's kind of their rule of thumb because they want to make sure that it's tested because once it's out there, it's really kind of a pain. You have to version if you want to fix bugs.
Yeah. And that's the issue is that the whole versioning thing is like, okay, well, how do we do this and not screw things up? And I actually started going down the road of building a custom API endpoint specifically for Zapier so that if we need to make changes to our API for things that happen inside of our interface, we can do that and it won't affect the things that are going on through Zapier. So that's kind of a workaround that is pretty helpful just because our API is still in flux and there's lots of things, other stuff going on. And then in terms of the public launch that I'm working towards. One thing, I'll get your feedback on this, but I'm considering going more down the route of like having multiple small launches as opposed to like one large one. And the idea would be that I'll gear up more towards a launch where I have like a set number of people that I want to put into the system. And I'm kind of thinking in my head about 20 right now. And then go for the launch, basically tell people up front, hey, I'm only letting 20 people in the door at the moment. And I could lay out my reasons why. Some of them are just to make sure that everybody's getting the attention they need, but also to make sure that if anything happens or if any bugs come up or if anyone has any specific needs as they come into it, then we have the time available to be able to address those. Whereas if I let in 100 or however many additional people in, it would be difficult to do that. It's hard to give everybody the attention that they need. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. I mean, that's kind of why I did the slow launch with Drip, was exactly this reason. Like, we just didn't have the staff to let hundreds of people in, and I knew that we would bleed out trials that we couldn't respond to quickly enough in terms of developing features or even fixing bugs. So that just, it can get really complicated and be just a big rush of people. So I think that's a good way to go. I don't know if they need to be monthly. I mean, I think they could be every 2 weeks or 3 weeks, depending on how long your trial is. Do you know how long your trial should be yet, or do you still have to figure that out? You're going to take a guess and then see how it goes?
I'm not actually at the point where I'm even considering offering a trial. What I'm doing now, and this is kind of a hybrid pricing model, where instead of offering like an annual plan and a monthly plan, what I'm doing is I'm offering a quarterly plan, because the value from the product does not surface itself for kind of at least a couple of months. It could be several weeks or a month or even 2 or 3 months before you start to see the value, just because of the pipeline of emails that you're sending through it and how long it can take people to respond. You might get responses immediately, but you might not get them for several weeks after a couple of emails. So I have a hard time believing that people would get value on day one or day five or something like that. So
no trial, do they pay up front for a
yes.
quarter? They pay
yep.
up front for a quarter at yep. a time. Got it. And you haven't had any issues so far. I mean, I don't think charging up front is a bad way to go at all, for sure, right? If you realize that you get a bunch of pushback on that, then maybe it's something you'll want to change. But it's a judgment call at this point, because you just don't have any data. So you have to make a call one way or another.
I haven't gotten any pushback so far. I mean, the people I've been putting on this past month or so, where I've just said, hey, it's charged quarterly and we charge up front, not one person has said, oh, well, are you sure? Or can we do this or that? Nobody's had any questions or pushback on it.
You'll have to see if you're able to sell it enough up front for someone to enter their card without talking to you, right? Because these people have all talked to you, and that'll just be an experiment. You'll have to do that first round and figure out what you think you're going to get from it. And then, since you are charging up front, you need to prove that there's going to be a lot of value to someone up front. So your marketing has to be really on point, right? And your pitch of what the product does and how it's going to do it for them needs to be on point. Because if you fumble that at all, there's friction. You know, there's friction of that quarterly payment that you're going to have to overcome. And that's not impossible to overcome. I don't think it's a bad call. You just don't have enough data at this point to know if it's going to work. The only thing I've heard people do quarterly with is membership sites. I've never heard a SaaS app do it. And I think it was Andrew Culver was saying that quarterly is like the worst of both worlds in terms of like accidental credit card churn. I forget what it is, if it's that it's not monthly so that banks, they're like suspicious of it, and so it'll get blocked more often or something like that. There's something about quarterly and how it's not a great way to bill in terms of involuntary churn. But I think you'll want to keep your eye on that. And if you switch to monthly later, I mean, you could always make it a quarterly payment and then let people switch to monthly down the line.
Yeah, that was actually probably what I was going to do longer term. The idea with the quarterly is, one, it puts people in a position where they don't get to the end of the first 30 days and they say, oh, well, I haven't used this yet, and they just want to cancel because they're not using it. And it gives me an opportunity to reach out to them, and I can see their usage and say, oh, you're not using this, let me help you get started with it, or let me help do things because I am so early. And then the other thing that it does is that it gives me the revenue for that up front. So if I do, let's say, a monthly launch, then I need, you know, a third of the number of people signing up to get the same amount of revenue that I would get 3 months down the road. So it helps from a cash flow perspective, and it also helps from the perspective of being able to put people on it and be confident that the system's not going to fall apart, and then also making sure that they're getting the value. And I don't anticipate doing quarterly long term. I mean, maybe the data will prove me wrong, but as a starting point, I think that it has a lot of benefits.
Yeah, I think if you do it and it works, I would not stop doing it. The cash flow is just too good. You know, if you can pull this off without a trial, get the money up front, obviously offer a 30-day money-back guarantee or whatever you want to offer, because that's going to be a sticking point for people as well. Question is, you know, what if I get in and I don't like it? And you want to be able to answer that. But I think if you can make this work and the numbers work, that it's not a bad way to go.
Mm-hmm. I definitely hear what Andrew Culver was saying about that. You know, it's the worst of both worlds. I hadn't thought about it in those terms, but I think right now the benefits of it outweigh the negatives, especially just since it's so early on. I just don't have any data to work with, and I may as well just try something.
That's right. Well, the other thing I like about doing smaller launches and having X spots is you can justify it, right? You can say, look, I just can't onboard more than 20 people. I don't think we can support more than 20 people in terms of answering all your questions. And so it's easy enough to justify because you are a small shop, but it also adds a little bit of that scarcity, right? So that if you email the list, then you can build that up and say, look, there's only 20 spots. And if you really want to get in, then you kind of got to do it now type thing. So I think there's a benefit on both sides in terms of making it more manageable for you and also being a nice little bit of marketing help there.
Well, I'll keep you guys posted on how that goes and we'll see how it shakes out.
Do you have a date for the initial launch?
Right now I'm targeting January 31st. So I've got some emails that I plan on sending out tomorrow and start kind of prime the launch queue, so to speak. We'll see how that goes. So what are we talking about today?
Well, we have a few listener questions I wanted to run through. The first is from Matt Visk, and he says, hey guys, love the show. I've created a SaaS company myself and would love your input on it. It's called PortfolioLounge.com. It helps people create their online portfolio. It has quite a few members with a handful of paid subscribers. I was wondering if you had any advice as to finding funding or interesting acquisition offers. I'm a developer at a large company, but I'd love to go full-time on Portfolio Lounge if I could. You have thoughts on this?
Not really. I mean, I'm not really in a position to kind of figure out what an acquisition offer would look like for something like that. And I'm not real familiar with like portfolio websites, to be honest. So you'd have more insight on this one.
Yeah. So, I mean, Matt, you know, acquisition offers at this point, if you have a handful of paid subscribers, they're going to be non-existent. Like there's just no, unless you have some unique technology that patent that somebody wants, or you have, you know, something Google algorithm or something like that, just having a handful of paid subscribers, even if you've spent years working on the code, launching and everything, it's all about revenue, right? It's actually all about net profit, or it's about strategic value. So net profit would be used in acquisitions like that FE International would handle. And if you were doing 20, 30K a year, which is not a tremendous amount, but if you're in that range, then you can approach someone like FE International or Quiet Light, Latona. I mean, there's several brokers out there and they can get you acquisition offers. But if you want the maximum purchase price where it's not, you know, 3.5 or 4 times net profit, but you might get 5 times revenue, the annual revenue, typically between, let's say, 3 to 7x annual revenue, then that's where you're getting like a strategic acquisition. And that's the kind of thing where you would really need to have a place in the market where a big strategic would want to acquire you. And it doesn't sound like you have that. So I don't think an acquisition offer is something you want to entertain. I just don't think you're going to be able to find any. In terms of finding funding, I mean, that's the kind of thing where, you know, you're going to go on AngelList. You may want to consider talking to someone, you know, like Bryce over at indie.vc. He was on the show, maybe 8 episodes ago. He funds kind of smaller apps like this. Or if you live in the Bay Area, my guess is you don't, but if you live in the Bay Area, there's going to be a bunch of options for you. So, and there are accelerators. I mean, there's a lot of options. It's like if you go to Google and talk about how to find startup funding, I mean, there's going to be options. So the question is do you want to do that? Like funding is not necessarily going to be the answer to what you're looking for. I think it's figuring out what your goals are and then finding the right options to kind of line up with that. So thanks for the question, Matt. Hope that's helpful. Our next question is about setting up a U.S. company as a non-U.S. citizen. It's from Justin, and he says, longtime listener from Taiwan. We're experiencing some tremendous growth on Amazon, and we'll be building some e-commerce-related SaaS apps in the near future. Our team members are scattered around the world, but our main market is in the U.S. Would like to hear your opinion of where to set up a company in the U.S. as a non-citizen and a non-resident. What do you think, Mike?
Well, I think that there's a kind of an underlying assumption here that you have to set up a company in the U.S. The situation is he's a non-citizen and non-resident. And I would question whether or not he has to set up a company inside the U.S. in order to do business. I mean, my thought here is that if your growth is coming from Amazon, then maybe that's a requirement, but I don't know for sure if it is. And if it's not, I mean, there's obviously a lot of different options for you to create a company, whether it's in Taiwan or it is based in some other country. I was listening to the Tropical MBA podcast a couple of days ago, and one of the episodes had on was about an e-residency program in Estonia, which I think was $100 to get into. And then you could base your company out of Estonia. And that gives you essentially a European address that allows you to use a lot of European SaaS services. I'm not positive of this. I think that Stripe would also be an option there as well. But you have to figure out where you're going to be able to get your services from, where your bank accounts are going to be, what the different tax implications are based on where your company is. And some of that comes back to how you're taxed in your home country versus how your business would be taxed in a foreign country. And something else you need to consider is that once you start crossing international borders, it can get much more complicated. If you're a U.S. citizen, you're going to get taxed no matter where you are and no matter where you're making your money, because the United States government wants their money. And, you know, there's a, I forget how much it is, but there's a cutoff number where above that amount, I think that they do not charge you taxes on anything below that certain amount. But
that's right, 90K.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure it's 90K or 180K for a couple.
Right.
So,
but that only applies if you're paying tax to a foreign government. Like, they'll basically give you credit for it. But anything above that, they say, yeah, you owe us taxes.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. It's the only country in the world that does that.
Yep.
Where if you live outside their borders, they still collect tax, which is, you know, there have been people who basically get residency somewhere else and then they give up their U.S. passport purely because of that.
Yep. So I guess I would just question the underlying assumption that you absolutely have to set up your business in the United States, but because it's Amazon, you may need to, but I would look into that. I think you have a lot of other options if you don't have to do that. Rob, I know that, you know, we talked offline a little bit about other options. You had some thoughts as well.
Yeah, and this is purely from hanging out with folks in the DC, and they, you know, are digital nomads, and so they have the option of setting up anywhere in the world, and most of them are U.S. citizens, and none of them have their companies in the U.S. Like, they're almost none of them. They tend to go to New Zealand and Hong Kong, and there's a bunch of reasons for that. And if you want, I'm sure the Tropical MBA or the DC would be a better place to go find out why. And you can even, there's you know, Google the Five Flags theory, and I think, yeah, it's Simon Black from Sovereign Man, and he talks a lot about this stuff, and he talks specifically about, you know, which countries are set up to be which flag and such. So all that to say, unless you need to have a U.S. company, I wouldn't do it. But if you do, it's typical to do it in Delaware, right? A Delaware Corp is one of the most common setups here in the States. Even companies that aren't located in Delaware tend to do that. And it's because they have very favorable business laws and a bunch of other stuff. So that'd be the most common. You'll want to either talk to LegalZoom or talk to a lawyer and have them set that up for you.
The other option for setting it up in the United States would be using Stripe's Atlas program, where it's $500 to get set up, and they will create a business account for you. You'll get incorporated. You can start accepting payments through Stripe. And then there's also options for getting tax and legal advice. I don't know the details of that. Patrick McKenzie would probably be a good person to reach out to about that, because he does work for Stripe now under their Atlas program. So that's another option if you had to do it in the United States.
I'm glad you brought that up. I would probably do that over the recommendation I just said of LegalZoom or finding a lawyer, because I bet Stripe has this dialed in, and you're going to probably want a Stripe account anyways, I would guess. And if it sets up a bank account and all that stuff, I mean, that's a big win. And for $500, kind of a no-brainer.
Yeah, I think that they also have this set up when you do that. They have this partnership with Amazon to get you like $15,000 in AWS credits. So if you need a hosted infrastructure of any kind, I mean, they can certainly help out there as well.
Awesome. Well, thanks for the question. I hope that's helpful. Our next question is from Steven Lieberman at skillsdbpro.com. And he says, love the podcast. I have a fast-growing business. I've made about 1,000 mistakes so far, but without your podcast and one or two others, I'm pretty sure that number would be 3,000. I'm a developer, and I just had to fire a developer. He's a contractor who knows his stuff, started out great. His first piece of work with me was outstanding. Though as the assignments progressed, he got slower and was billing more time for less work. I'm working on similar items and getting them done in half the time. There may have been a combination of issues. One big thing is that he started working in 2-hour spurts, which obviously makes it hard to really get up to speed. I tried to address this with him, and he kept ignoring those part of the text. So after he finished his last assignment, I let him go. Letting someone go is hard to do because onboarding someone else is a lot of work and a lot of my time, as you know. So here's my question. What are the breaking points when you choose to let someone go? I really struggle on how much time I should spend to fix the situation or just cut my losses and move on. So other than the obvious, i.e. they're stealing from you, what are your thoughts, not only for developers, but for all positions?
I think for this, it kind of comes down to your personal feelings on what the future looks like. So if you are feeling like whenever they do work, you have to go in and double check it to make sure that it's right, or the directions and stuff, the course corrections that you try to put in place, and you tell them, for example, in this case, you sent them texts and said, hey, this is what I need to happen, and those pieces of the texts were ignored. The next step may be to send them a single standalone message that says, hey, this is incorrect, or this is a problem and we need to resolve it. And if as a standalone message is still ignored or not corrected, then at that point you kind of need to pull the plug. For me, it's more of a personal feeling that I get to a certain point and there's this nagging sense in the back of my mind that says, hey, you have to go double check this, or you have to keep following up. And it's almost like there's this weight hanging over you that you have to stay on top of whoever that person is and make sure that they're doing their job right. And essentially you're becoming a micromanager. And as soon as that happens, they're no longer helping you in the business. It's actually hurting you, because then it's distracting you. It's taking time away from doing other things. It's taking your mental energy away from other things. And it's just kind of a nightmare to deal with at that point. I mean, it's more hassle than it's worth. And that's really the breaking point. But there's not, I wouldn't say a set thing that, you know, if X happens or X or Y happens. I mean, obviously they're stealing from you those obvious things. Sure. Yeah. Pull the plug immediately. But I feel like it's more of a general sense of being aware of how you feel about moving forward with a person. And if it's not something that is able to be corrected, then just you have to pull the plug.
Yeah. I feel like Steve handled this pretty well. I mean, if he was trying to address it and was bringing it up and the guy was ignoring it, I mean, that's a big red flag. I think that the question is different if they're a contractor or a W-2 employee. I would definitely spend more time if someone were W-2. I'd also do a lot more vetting up front. But if their performance went down, let's say you hired someone who is good, easy to work with, and then their performance is going down over time, I would definitely bring it up and try to help them and find out what's going on and how you can turn it around. Do they need to take some time off? Are they burned out? Are they trying to do another job? You know, you got to try to figure out, like, are they kind of screwing you and overbilling you and not actually working the hours? Or are they running into personal issues or something? So that's for an employee. With a contractor, I would tend to kind of, I'll say give them warnings, but it wouldn't be things like, I'm going to fire you if you don't do this. It would be more like Steve did, where to reach out and be like, look, your performance at this point, it's just, you're not delivering nearly what you used to. And we really need to talk about this. It's an issue. And if I brought that up a couple times and they ignored me, then they'd be done, because there's no excuse for that. Like, if you can't communicate with me, then there is no relationship that's going to come out of that. It's just too hard to try to manage someone who's going to not be able to communicate or have a conversation with you. So, you know, all that to say, I think I have a little bit less tolerance for contractors, because you don't have as much of a relationship with them. You're not as invested in them. They're never as invested in you or your company. And so if it's not working out, it is a bummer to have to onboard someone new, but sounds to me like you made the right choice. So thanks for the question, Steve. I hope that was helpful. Our next one is from Michael, and he says, I love your podcast. It's my favorite by far, so please keep up the good work. I'm what you might call a wannapreneur. I dream about getting out of the rat race, being my own boss, etc. I have a few average ideas, but don't think any of them are worth pursuing. My desired entrepreneurial destination is a B2B biz with $10,000 a month in revenue. I have the will to work hard, but I already make decent money at my job, which I think is part of what's keeping me from ideating more. I also have a wife and kids, so my time is not limitless, but I make time when I really want to. I get up a couple hours early most mornings to read and study. Perhaps I'm too much of a learner and analyzer and not enough of a doer. Recently, I've split my time tracking into three parts. Part one is family and fun. Part two is the day job. And part three is the side business, which is currently only imaginary plus learning. I've been consistently filling up one and two, but I feel hopeless with number three, except for learning. I beat myself up constantly for not making more progress there. And that affects my mood, which in turn hurts my family's well-being too. What would you advise as I continue to strive towards entrepreneurship? I think the first question you want to ask yourself is, do you really want this? Like, do you really, really want it? Because if you haven't pushed forward on it yet and you have a comfy job, like, it's not for everybody. And in fact, it's a long road where you're going to be making a lot less than your current job for years. Remember Harry Hollander's talk, or maybe it was Ted Pitts from Moreware Software at MicroConf a couple years ago. And they look back at what they would have been making at their jobs had they stayed. And they were like 7-8 years into their business, and it was doing multiple seven figures. And they had just like broken even at that point in terms of what they would have made. So if it's purely a monetary decision, then stick with the job. Like, it's just an easier path. It's less distracting and it's more straightforward. But if you really, really do want to get out of it, then yeah, you have to take some strides towards doing and really cut out the learning at this point. I would guess that you know enough that you need to like take the plunge and actually start putting code to paper, as they say, and you know, really get something out there. And whether it's just launching something at this point, and whether you give yourself a challenge of launching something small every month for 6 months, not a bad way to go. Force yourself to do it. Or whether you want to launch a blog or just launch a little WordPress plugin, like pick something small and get it out into the wild, because without experience, you just have no idea how to put the learnings into action. And so I would pick a kind of a small project that is not a SaaS app, you know, like I've often said with the stair-step approach here, pick an ebook or a video course or a WP plugin or an add-on to Photoshop or an add-on to Shopify, or, you know, just something small that you can charge a bit of money for and see what that feels like to do it and ship something. Because it's probably a lot harder than you think. And it's also probably going to give you more experience in that 1 month of doing it than you can learn in 2 years of listening to podcasts and reading blogs.
I think Rob's on the right track with asking if it's something that you really wanted to. I'd had a conversation, I was either last year or the year before, with somebody. We were actually discussing my sleep habits, to be honest, which is kind of a slight tangent. But the question that we were kind of trying to discuss was, why can't I get up earlier? Because I'll be honest, like, I've always had a hard time getting up early. It's just never been something that is wired in my DNA. I do not like mornings. If I were president of the United States, I would abolish mornings and there would be nothing before noon. That said, like, the question that was posed to me was, what are the punitive damages of you not getting up early? What are the downsides of you not getting up early? And I'm like, well, I own my own business, so I can get up kind of at any time I want. And he's like, exactly, that's the problem. He's like, your issue is that there's no downside, there's no negative consequences to not getting up early. So you just don't have to. So you really have to have this external force of some kind in certain situations to push you in that direction. And it sounds to me like there's no external force that's really pushing you to the point that says, hey, you have to build this business. And it doesn't sound to me like it's something that you want hard enough. There's no driving passion for it. I mean, you've got a job, you don't find it exciting, but it's not like you're going to get fired or let go in 3 months and you know that that's coming. So there's no drive behind that to say, hey, you have to buckle down, you have to put this time aside. And you see that with various studies about people in college, for example, where they are given 6 weeks to do a project, and then there's another group of people that are given 1 week to do the project. And the people who are given 1 week, they get it done. The people who are given 6 weeks, they wait till week four or five and then start it. Yeah, I mean, and it goes back to Parkinson's law, which basically says that work expands so as to fill the time available for its completion. And this is a prime example of that, where you've got this side business that you want to work long term, but there's nothing really forcing your hands to make it work. And if it's fun to you and it's interesting and you enjoy doing it, then it's much easier to spend the time on it. But if you kind of like doing it and you have this longer term vision where you want to do it at some point in the future, but there's nothing really pushing you hard towards it, then you're probably just not going to. And I think that that's probably the fundamental problem here. It's not so much that you can't do it, it's that you don't need to. So, you know, you kind of have to ask yourself, is that something you really want? Or is it just something that you would like to have at some point, but isn't really a passion of yours?
And our last question for the day is from Adam Kelso. And he says, hey guys, thanks so much for the tons of great advice and experience you give in each episode. I know you target the show at Startup Founders, but I was wondering if you had any thoughts on evaluating startups as an employee. I live in Austin, which has a huge tech community, and there are a lot of startups to choose from. Some have good reputations. Most are too new for anyone to know much about. If you were considering working at a startup as an employee, knowing what you know now, what would you look for and what would you avoid? Interesting question.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting question. I think that what I do is I probably look for an environment where you could be very collaborative with people. Like, if it's a small company, if it's a startup, then your expectation is probably going to be that you're going to be working closely with the founder or founders of the company. So you want to make sure that you're able to work well with them. And rather than jumping in and, you know, trying to provide value and skip from one job to another, I think what I might do is offer them, for example, the opportunity to do some contract or consulting work for them. And that does a couple of different things. One is it makes sure that they have money available. You'll kind of get the inside scoop on how things are really going. Because I think that the last thing you want to do is quit your job to go work for one of these companies and then find out that they don't have the revenue to support you and they have to let you go in a month or 3 months or something like that. So I think that that's one side of it. And being able to offer that is going to be attractive to them as well, because you are going to be able to show your value and your worth to the company. So if you were able to put in the time outside of your current working hours, then it gives them an opportunity to understand who you are and how you work. And if you decide at the end of a couple of weeks or a month or two of working for them part-time that you don't like what they're working on, or you don't see a future in it, or you just don't like the people that you're working with, then you can move on and go to something else. And that's really just hedging your bets more than anything else. In terms of specific things to watch out for or red flags, I'm not sure, because most of these companies, as you said, they're going to be too new and you're not going to really have any sort of anything to go on. There's not going to be a whole lot of public information about them. You could ask people who you know about them, but chances are good that unless those people have kind of been active in the community, you're not going to get any information out of it, and you're not going to know people who know them. So that'll just be a difficult situation to be in.
Yeah, I think I would step back and kind of ask yourself the question, why do you want to work for a startup? Because working for startups, you're going to do it for most likely less pay than you would if you went to work at a larger company. And you're going to get this promise of some eventual payout, right, in the form of stock options. That's the traditional way it's done. So you're putting a lot of risk there. You're basically not making as much money as you otherwise could in order to perhaps have a more exciting job. Maybe that's what you're looking for. So, you know, it could be less boring. Or maybe you are looking for the payout. I probably wouldn't do it for that unless you're joining as like a employee number 1, 2, or 3. If you're just kind of joining later, it's probably going to be trivial amounts of options. So I think, you know, with that stuff in mind, like something I would look out for or really kind of vet is A, how much funding have they raised? When did they raise it? How viable are they financially? Do I believe in the business idea? Or do I think it's kind of a dumb idea? Because there's a lot of just ideas that I think are stupid and I would not enjoy working on them. So I would sit down, and if you have this list of startups and there's some that sound really interesting, see what you can find out about like their financial situation in terms of burn rate, in terms of getting their next round of funding, because stuff can go sideways really quickly. And if a company has, you know, only raised an angel round or whatever, if you have no problem finding a job, then, you know, maybe you do take a flyer on one of these. But if you're concerned about, you know, them going under and then you being unemployed for a few months or something, if there's an economic downturn, then you'll just want to be more mindful of that. So I think that's the thought process I would go through. I know that working at a startup, I worked for like a credit card startup, and I think I was developer number 3 or 4 that was hired there. And when I left, we were at 25 or 30 developers. And it was a lot of fun in the early days. And then as we got bigger, it became, you know, less fun, as companies do. And one reason that I went to work for them is they did have a buckets of funding and I needed stability at the time. This is 10, 12 years ago. So I had the mortgage, was married and that kind of stuff. And I was much more risk averse than I am today in terms of being willing to kind of risk employment and all that. And it turned out to be a good decision. I did make a little bit of money off the options and things can work out. But the vast majority of time, it doesn't, right? The vast majority of time, they do go under. I mean, the vast majority of startups fail. And so keep that in mind. Think to yourself, you know, if I come to work for these guys for 6 months, my options are worth nothing at the end of that, and I don't have a job, am I still okay with it? And if you are, then cool, do it, because it'll probably be a fun ride. Now, I've also heard folks who go and work and they grind out these 70-hour weeks for 2 years, and then everything goes south, and then they really, really regret it because they're now burned out and they have no job. Their options aren't worth anything. And the opportunity cost of all the money that they could have made doing another job is a bummer. So I guess that's the last factor I would think of, is like, how many hours are these folks going to expect you to work? Because some startups really are 40-hour week startups. And that's how we were at Drip. You know, we didn't expect everybody to work 50, 60 hours. And I think that's a definitely more sustainable way to do it. You know, and then some are 60, 70-hour startups. And so that's probably something to think about, ask about up front.
I didn't even think to mention it, but my question was geared more towards working for like a self-funded startup, not necessarily. Yeah. So
and
like, because yeah. I don't think that strategy would work at all for a funded startup, because they're probably hiring because they need somebody and they need a body, to be honest. Like, I've seen a lot of people, a lot of companies where they're a startup company and they've got funding and they're just like, we need somebody to handle this, and they will take whoever they can get, and they're not willing to wait 6 months to find the right person. They need somebody in the next 3 to 4 weeks, you know, and I don't think that working for a company like that part-time is even going to be an option. You know, it depends on who you're talking to, but I had it more in mind of like doing that for like a self-funded startup as opposed to like a funded startup.
Cool. So there's two perspectives. Hope that was helpful.
Well, I think that about wraps us up for the day. If you have a question for us, you can call it into our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690, or you can email it to us at questions@startupsforrestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt for We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. Subscribe to us on iTunes by searching for Startups, and visit startupsforrestofus.com for a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.